rising on a daily basis. And unfortunately, so far, we are not seeing any real intervention from outside. So at least we could have a glimmer of hope that this will end soon. Yeah.
And Yusuf Hamash, how do you respond to Prime Minister Netanyahu's claim that denying that there's starvation and alleging that it is groups under Hamas in Gaza that are preventing the delivery of aid?
And I work for the Norwegian Refugee Council, and we operate on the ground, mainly in Rafah currently, because we don't have any access for the northern part of Gaza, and we didn't see any evidence or related to these allegations. All what we are looking for is open the checkpoints, the Israeli restriction that have been put to split Gaza into three pieces now. And we don't have access for Khan Yunis now, and there is no access from to Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza. And we are talking about over 500,000 who are trapped there, dying to fulfill their children basic needs. We had the first day of Ramadan yesterday, and I was reaching out for friends and colleagues in the northern part of Gaza, and I was trying to understand exactly what they could find to have iftar, mainly a piece of bread with tea. The situation in the south is also chaos and chaotic and getting worse every day, but in the northern part of Gaza, people are literally on the verge of famine. People are dying to find a piece of bread there, and it's unacceptable that we start to put these allegations here and there. There is a need on the ground that's very clear. If we go on social media, media outlets, wherever you go, you could see exactly what's going on there. So it's unrealistic, and it's not acceptable, actually, just to ignore and deny that there is a famine in the north.
I wanted to go to Khalil Abu Ziyada, a Palestinian currently in the Al-Shati camp in Gaza.
My feeling is that of a person who was displaced from his house. I'm 71 years old, and I have never experienced Ramadan with this feeling. It's an awful feeling. At times like this during Ramadan, I used to prepare the dining table to eat at sunset. But today there's no food, and I don't have money to get food for iftar at sunset.
So, Yusuf Hamash, the United States, President Biden, has been authorizing the dropping of food, airdropping it. Five people were killed, crushed to death by a malfunctioning parachute that was carrying one of the food drops. And now is proposed this pier where they say they'll get food in, unclear how, considering what Israel's been doing. All of their ports of entry or all of their crossings are closed and not allowing food to come in from Rafah. Why would the pier be any different, especially given that the U.S. continues to provide the bombs and the ammunition that is dropped on the Palestinians?
That's what makes it you don't understand exactly what's going on. First of all, any help for it to feed even one single family or one single child in the northern part of Gaza or Gaza or in the south is very welcomed and much appreciated. But let's go be realistic. Spending all of these efforts, building the boat or airdropping, which is not efficient, unfortunately, and you have mentioned exactly what happened when that incident killing five of people. And imagining that all of media show, all of that, what we saw related to the airdropping was less than 2 aid trucks. Why the United States didn't use its influence to its closest ally, that it's while it's weaponizing them, and using that influence in a proper way to force them, to impose on them, to remove restriction on aid. And it's going to be more simple, more realistic, and more efficient if the United States have pushed the Israelis to allow to aid truck to go into people in need in the northern part of Gaza and Gaza City. And imagine the distance between Rafah crossing and the northern part of Gaza is half an hour by drive. So why we need to spend all that amount of effort building a seaport or airdropping while we have a realistic option that put in front of us, but there is just some restriction by the Israelis. And so that's what makes it unimaginable Why we are going to that option? While we already we have different options on the ground, and it's still in place, running and functioning in place since the almost the beginning of this chaos. This the only issue that we are facing in delivering the aid on the ground is the restriction that the Israelis put in it for Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza.
And Yusuf Hamash, how are you faring, your family and your own children under these conditions? What kind of aid do you have access to?
Yani in Rafah, there is kind of affordability, but unfortunately, the prices also are not affordable somehow. Yani there is some people who could get some of the food items, especially into Rafah. There is kind of availability, but unfortunately, the inflation of prices make it unaffordable for the majority of the families here. We are living day by day here. Our cycle of life is one day. We fulfill our basic needs as responsible towards our children and extended families, and then we will look for the next day. As an example, yesterday I had to search after my working hours up to the iftar timing just to look for some vegetables, and I couldn't find it. Maybe I was late because there is 1.5 million are in Rafah, this 55 square kilometer, and we are competing to find food for our families.
Yusuf Hamash, we thank you so much for being with us. Advocacy officer in Gaza for the Norwegian Refugee Council, joining us from Rafah. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue to report on Gaza, we're joined by Francesca Albanese, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, joining us from Tunis today. As you listen to the report on the ground in Rafah, and you hear also, in addition to international groups, a dozen Israeli human rights organizations are demanding of the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, that Israel abide by its demand, request. You can explain whether it's legally binding to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza, and Netanyahu's denial that there is a famine problem.
Hi, Amy and Juan, and thank you for having me back. First of all, it's very painful to listen to the testimonies from Gaza, because as someone who has seen this tragedy unfolding, this catastrophe unfolding from the very beginning, and knowing that the situation in Gaza was already desperate for many, before the 7th of October. I hear them in pain, especially at the time that it's holy, like the Ramadan. I'm glad Israeli organizations are forcefully asking for compliance with international law, because this is what has been violated through and through. International law sets clear obligation on warring parties to deliver aid and allow and facilitate the rapid and unimpeded passage of humanitarian relief to the civilians in need in situation of armed conflict. And this is all the more serious in Gaza, given that on the 26th of January, the International Court of Justice issued an order that request Israel to take immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the adverse conditions of life faced by Palestinians in Gaza. This has not happened. On the contrary, after the 26th of January, we have seen, on the one hand, increasing fighting, increasing shelling and killing of civilians desperately gathering for aid, the bombing of convoys and airdropped food, although the airdropped food in any case is dangerous, as we have seen. It has killed people in Gaza, and it's a hazard. It cannot deliver the aid to everyone in need. On the other hand, we have seen also the deliberate targeting of UNRWA, which is the only organization who can orderly deliver humanitarian aid and food, on top of the increasing restrictions on the aid that can come in. In the face of all these, Amy, I I certainly welcome the opening of a humanitarian corridor, of a maritime corridor between Cyprus and the Gaza Strip. At the same time, this risks to be a drop in the ocean, as if it was said before. The crossing between Israel and Gaza are not open, and if the humanitarian access is not fully guaranteed within the scope of a ceasefire, because ultimately the only way to save lives is to stop bombing the Gaza Strip.
Well, Francesca Albanese, we've been hearing now for weeks that negotiations were proceeding any day. There would be a ceasefire any day, but the days keep passing and the war continues. Do you feel that the United States and the Western powers are doing enough to pressure Israel on the issue of ceasefire?
I see the United States and most Western powers doing enough to continue this situation, this monstrosity, because there is no other way to qualify this. And certainly not enough is being done to prevent it, because the only thing at this point, and again, I want to stress once again, there is an order of the ICJ which imposes obligations not just on Israel, but also on third states. And these obligations are being violated. They're sent back to they refer back to the Genocide Convention. So it's very critical what they are doing and not doing, and this might entail responsibilities for these states as well. But what should be done is an arms embargo right now and sanctions, because Israel is not in compliance with critical measures ordered by the ICJ, and this is not something that should be treated with negligence.
Francesca Albanese, do you know why Karim Khan of the International Criminal Court, the other court outside of the International Court of Justice, has not brought Netanyahu up on charges? He immediately did after Putin invaded Ukraine. I think something like 10,000 Ukrainians with a far larger population have died, and that in itself is horrific. But we're talking about 30,000, more than 30,000 Palestinians, all agree, overwhelmingly civilian. And yet, the International Criminal Court has not brought charges.
I cannot say with certainty, because I don't know what his motives are. I want to imagine that his team is diligently preparing arrest warrants for anyone who needs to receive an arrest warrant. The fact that it has not happened yet is shocking. But to be honest, for me, it's shocking that there had been no effective move by the ICC even before the 7th of October, because the continuous building of settlements in the West Bank and the Gaza, and East Jerusalem, the taking of land, the advancing of the annexation plan, these were already war crimes falling squarely in the jurisdiction of the ICC. So there has been a delay in the situation of Palestine that might also be understandable as presenting the political pressure that is on anyone operating at the international level. So I don't want to put the burden only on the ICC prosecutor. There is a clear double standard when it comes to Palestine, also possibly resented across other parts of the global south. But clearly, the fact that in Ukraine we have had 0.2% of the population killed, and in Gaza 1.3% of the population killed, and 4.5% of the population either killed, reported missing, or injured, and no arrest warrant. In the face of genocidal incitement and clear orders given that have targeted the entire population as a whole as responsible for what happened, the tragic events of the 7th of October. This is disappointing, to say the least.
We have less than a minute. UNRWA, you talked about the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Although more than a dozen countries, 16, 17 countries, stopped funding. Canada and Sweden have resumed Israel not presenting evidence that they said Hamas was UNRWA was involved with Hamas. Yet the United States, by far the largest funder of UNRWA, has not. What is the effect of this in 30 seconds?
The effect is that it undermines the operations of UNRWA across the region, not only in Gaza, but the entire Near East, in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. And there is no legal basis to do so. So this only aggravates the responsibility of the United States.
Francesca Albanese, I want to thank you for being with us, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, today speaking to us from Tunis, Tunisia. Next up, as President Biden pushes a bipartisan bill to crack down on immigrants, a Washington, D.C. group is reporting a death and two suicide attempts at the Northwest Detention Center run by the private GEO group. Back in 20 seconds.
Con su falda de retazos, remendaba el mundo entero. La costura es lo primero en un mundo que se hace pedazo. Cual recuerdo en su regazo, surció telas que vistieran de ilusión por vez primera, con trazos de un hilo fino, a los sueños.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As President Biden pushes a bipartisan bill to crack down on immigrants, we end today's show in Tacoma, Washington, where the advocacy group Resistencia is reporting there were two suicide attempts Monday, just hours apart, at the Northwest Detention Center. This comes less than a week after a 61-year-old man from Trinidad and Tobago, identified as Charles Leo Daniel, died at the ICE prison. He'd been in deportation proceedings for 4 years and was in solitary confinement at Northwest when he was found unresponsive Thursday morning. No cause of death has been determined. But according to La Resistencia, witnesses who saw local authorities retrieve Leo's body from the isolation unit, they described it as a possible suicide. This is Christian Duenas, an immigrant from El Salvador, who's been detained at Northwest for nearly 2 years. La Resistencia said Duenas was also being held in isolation at the time of Leo's death.
When the alarm went off at around 10:45 a.m., I was in the library and I was told that someone in solitary confinement was found unresponsive. I was brought back to my cell at around 11:30 a.m. and I saw a lot of people running around everywhere. The police arrived in the fire department. I saw that a man who was black appeared as if he had hung himself.
Did you see him?
I saw him as he was being taken out.
A 2020 report by the University of Washington Center for Human Rights found ICE's own data shows the Northwest Detention Center, quote, detains people longer on average in solitary confinement than any other dedicated ICE facility in the nation. Meanwhile, Friday, a federal judge blocked Washington State from enforcing most of a law intended to increase oversight at the for-profit detention center run by GEO Group, one of the largest in the country. For more, we go to Tacoma, where we're joined by Maru Moro Villalpando, an immigrant rights activist and co-founder of the advocacy group La Resistencia. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Maru. So tell us about this latest news, the death last week, the two suicide attempts, and the situation right now at NWDC.
Good morning, Amy and Juan. Yes, we are mourning right now in La Resistencia. We heard from Christian, as you heard, he called us during the day to describe what happened in the segregation unit. We immediately mobilized. We also asked local journalists to find out what's going on. They confirmed through the Tacoma Police Department what was told to us. We are kind of private investigators because we have to go in and try to get as much information as possible that we know ICE is not going to release. As a matter of fact, we actually sent a press release 20 minutes ahead of them with mostly very accurate information based on the little we know. And then we get another couple of calls yesterday from different units describing attempted suicides. As all the information was being put together, we had already scheduled a vigil last night. Our members of our team and supporters were outside the detention center at 7 p.m., and they witnessed the Tacoma Police Department patrol cars leaving the detention center, and right after a fire department truck and an ambulance. We assumed that the person that committed attempted suicide around 6 p.m. was the one being transported to the hospital in that ambulance. This is a very dangerous place. We said it for 10 years now. We just turned 10 last week, exactly the day that La Resistencia was founded 10 years later. And March 7, 2024 is the day that Mr. Daniel is found dead in his segregation cell. So this tells us the importance and the urgency to shut down the detention center now.
And Maru, what can you tell us about why this particular detention center holds people for so long in deportation proceedings, and why the conditions there are seem to be so especially brutal?
Well, it's a private detention center. It's operated and owned by GEO Group. It opened in 2004. It expanded three times after it expanded. But once we started our fight, we were able to stop their expansion. We have been able to switch everything around on how people saw this detention center. But it's one of the most expensive detention centers in the country. ICE and GEO always brag about their quote-unquote dental chair and their medical service. What we have done is that we expose the opposite of what they brag about. But being a private detention center, being one of the most expensive ones, and having a contract with a minimum guarantee of 1,100 beds daily, that means that ICE, you and I, with our taxes, will pay for at least 1,100 beds daily, regardless of the number of people that are detained. So it is in GEO's and ICE benefit to get as many people as possible and the longest possible. We have seen people detained for over 6 years. You saw that Mr. Daniel was detained for 4 years. Most of that time, based on another witness that has been in segregation on and off for the past 2 years. He saw Mr. Daniel also in segregation for the past 2 years. We have way too many instances of people being detained in segregation, either because they have mental illnesses, either because they are asking for quote-unquote protection, or basically because people are organizing and speaking up. That's the case of Christian Dueñas. He was placed in segregation because he has been speaking to us. And since November of last year, when we finished the year with a hunger strike of 52 days straight, we noticed an increase of retaliation against those that speak to us while in detention. GEO guards, we can hear them in the back when we do video calls with people in detention, yelling at them that if they're talking to La Resistencia, their tablets will be taken away. And so this retaliation technique of sending people to segregation creates also a higher number of days of use in solitary confinement in this facility. This facility also is the one with the lowest bond rate in the country. Only 3% of those that ask for bond are actually accepted, and then they could possibly be released. So this detention center has shown itself as one of the most repressive ones in the country. A person that we saw yesterday, he told us he's been in many ICE and GEO facilities. So far, this is the worst that he's been at.
As we look at these conditions on the ground that you're describing, deaths, suicide attempts, clearly, immigration is a political football in this election year. And I wanted to go to Republican Alabama Senator Katie Britt, facing backlash over telling this highly misleading story during her much-criticized response to President Biden's State of the Union last week.
When I took office, I took a different approach. I traveled to the Del Rio sector of Texas. That's where I spoke to a woman who shared her story with me. She had been sex trafficked by the cartels starting at the age of 12. She told me not just that she was raped every day, but how many times a day she was raped.
So Britt was using this example to attack Biden. What the senator didn't say is that this horrific situation described by this woman took place during the administration of President George W. Bush, that the abuse took place in Mexico, and that drug cartels were not involved. Now, the woman who Senator Britt referenced, Carla Jacinto, appeared on CNN over the weekend and said this.
Yes. In fact, I hardly ever cooperate with politicians because it seems to me that they only want an image. They only want a photo. And that to me is not fair. I work as a spokesperson for many victims who have no voice, and I really would like them to be empathetic. All the governors, all the senators, to be empathetic with the issue of human trafficking, because there are millions of girls and boys who disappear all the time, people who are really trafficked and abused, as she mentioned. And I think she should first take into account what really happens before telling a story of that magnitude.
So, Maru, can you respond to how this is being, how this whole immigrant issue and the crisis immigrants face is being dealt with?
We're being used. We're being used either to make money. We're being used either to gain votes. We're being used as the scapegoats. We're constantly used because we're one of the most vulnerable populations. We don't vote, right? We're not expected to vote. That's why we will never see an immigration reform really happening ever. It's about population control. It's about controlling black and brown bodies that are being forced to migrate in the first place. And once we get here, our stories are even stolen from us. They're being co-opted by cheap politicians that dare to mislead their base. But it works. And that's why we see it again and again and again. All of these electoral times is just a deja vu every time for us. We know they're going to use a story, either a very, very horrible story like this woman's story, or it could be someone that committed some sort of crime. When in reality, what's going on is these big corporations such as Geo, such as Signature FBO, such as Global Crossing Airlines, all these companies that make money off detention and deportation, that are lobbying precisely for this kind of cheap politics to deviate from the real causes of what's going on. What's going on is that the same government created this crisis. We are in this midst of horrible, horrible situations in detention centers, at the border, in the countries where people need to flee, because it's working for corporations and for governments. And we're tired of being the political pawns. And that's why we're not waiting for the government to solve this. We have to save ourselves. And that's why we work directly with people in detention. They're calling Resistencia because they trust us. They know that we will get everything out, that the people in the outside will know what's going on inside. ICE is trying to hide everything. They purposely sent a press release about Mr. Daniel's death, and they purposely set aside, they did not mention that he was in segregation. There's so much to hide. There's so many things ICE and GEO and all these companies don't want the public to know. And that's why we exist. Because again, if it's not up to us, we won't be saved by the government.
And Maru, we just have about 30 seconds, but you mentioned the private flight companies. Could you talk about what you've been tracking about flights from Seattle's Boeing Field, King County International Airport?
Since they resumed last year in May, we have been observing flights every week. In the past 3 weeks, we have not been successful to observe almost anything, because now this company that is the one that allowed these flights to come back, Signature FBO, that willingly started a contract with ICE to service their flights, which their contract with the airplane company Global Crossing Airlines, they decided to switch the plane around. We are not able to see anymore. They're blocking our view. GEO buses are blocking our view. They don't want us to see people being handcuffed and being put in the planes.
Maru Villalpando, we have to leave it there. We want to thank you so much for being with us with the group La Resistencia. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Indulge yourself in the cultural and folklore traditions of Italy on Il Sole Italiano every Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m.
Eravamo ancora fanciulli e ogni sera su